Hello, my name is Harold Felder, and welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. Today we have a very important topic to talk about, and that topic is evolution. And to talk about this with me, I have Prem Isaac. Let me tell you a little bit about Prem. Prem has an undergraduate degree in physics and computer science, very logical. He's pursuing a Master of Arts in Apologetics at Southern Evangelical Seminary. And he also taught on evolution at churches and at college campuses to enlighten the young minds. So Prem, is there anything else you would like to add? Is there anything about yourself that you would like to tell us?
I would like to add that I used to be an evolutionist. That was the main reason why I did not embrace Christianity. Now I'm no longer an evolutionist. And what I do is I go about showing why evolution is not a theory to be believed.
And this is a perfect example of why I am doing this show. Because once people see that evolution just makes no sense, that it is not viable, then that sort of peels away some of the foundation that they were standing on that allowed them to oppose Christianity, that allowed them to oppose the belief in a God and the Creator.
Exactly.
And so that's what we're going to talk about. So, Prem, what is evolution?
When we speak about evolution, it can mean more than one thing. We could speak about the evolution of the universe, which is really the prevailing theory taught today on how the universe came into existence, including all the stars and the planets. And we can also talk about organic evolution, which is what we'll be focusing on today, which is biological evolution, or how living organisms came to be. So the theory of organic evolution is basically the idea that all animals and plants came from a common ancestor, and that all animals and plants are always changing slowly and gradually over time by an unguided random process involving no intelligence, going from simple organisms, simple plants, maybe one-celled organisms, all the way to complex plants and animals, resulting in human beings.
So how did evolution first start? I mean, what's the theory about how the first cell or the first being or whatever entity came about?
Well, when we speak about how evolution started, many people think that it started with Charles Darwin. It's true that Charles Darwin is the father of the modern theory of evolution, but evolution as an idea or concept has existed for thousands of years. Even the Greeks believed in the great chain of being, where they actually believed that all different plants, animals, and human beings shared a common origin. So evolution has its roots going back thousands of years.
Right.
But the form of evolutionary theory that we have today really began with Charles Darwin. He was the first one who articulated the main ideas that led to the theory of evolution. So Darwinism is the idea that slow and gradual changes in the structure of organisms is all that's needed to explain how one organism changes into another organism.
That's one of the things I want to touch on something real quick. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, we're talking about something evolving from one stage to another. But one of the things that evolution does not do, it does not explain where we got the original substances from that came together to form the first life. So it still doesn't answer the question of origin. It just maybe answers the question of how something became more complex.
Absolutely. Evolution, organic evolution, assumes a lot of things. It assumes that the right, in other words, organic evolution starts with the spontaneous generation of the first living organism from something that wasn't alive to begin
right,
with.
Right,
so
right.
It assumes that all the necessary chemicals in the right proportions and the temperature and the pressure and the environment was all set up. It assumes that this was so randomly and that suddenly, for no apparent reason, as an accident, the first a living organism was formed.
Right, right. So distinguish the difference between microevolution and macroevolution.
Right. Distinguishing the terms are very important. Microevolution is also called variation, or the existence of varieties within a certain kind of plant or animal. For example, we could speak about the various different kinds of dogs that there are. Everything from a Chihuahua, which is just a few inches tall, to the Great Dane, which is, I don't know, 3 feet, 2 or 3 feet tall, a very tall variety of dog. So variation or microevolution is something that you can observe. Plants and animals within each kind have different varieties. If you look at butterflies or moths, you would see different varieties. So these variations are observable and they're common. And in fact, human beings have actually bred, they've used the fact of microevolution to breed new varieties of dogs, varieties of oranges, tangerines, grapefruits. They're all part of the same
seedless
kind.
Grapes.
Absolutely. seedless grapes, green ones, green grapes, purple grapes, red grapes. It's all part of what we can do using microevolution. So microevolution is real, it's observable.
Right.
But what you don't get is new versions, new types of organisms.
Yeah.
Now that's what the theory of macroevolution is about. It's an attempt to explain how brand new organisms with brand new functionality emerge. For example, an animal that could not fly evolves, according to the theory of macroevolution, into an animal that can fly.
Right.
So there it's acquired a brand new function. Macroevolution is not observable.
Right.
And it is that type of theory that I stand against and try to expose.
Now, that's a very, very important point. And I want to make this clear. I'm going to ask you a question, and I think this is going to answer a lot of questions. Have macroevolution, the evolution that evolutionists and Darwinists talk about, the thing, you know, something going from one species to another, has that ever been observed?
Absolutely not.
Is there any evidence that it has ever happened?
Absolutely not.
Why do we hear about it all the time?
Well, the real reason why evolution is propagated is that underlying evolution is a philosophy of materialism. The idea of materialism is simply that all of nature, all of reality, should be explained without appealing to the supernatural.
Yeah.
So evolution helps propagate the underlying philosophy of materialism. It's a form of materialism, really.
Yeah.
And it's really a philosophical issue as to why evolution is believed and taught.
Right.
Because the basic premise of materialism is that there is no personal, intelligent God who could give rise to all the complexity of life that we see today.
And we know that materialism is not true. We know that materials aren't all that there is, because there are things that we deal with every day that aren't material. I mean, we have emotions, but emotions aren't material.
Absolutely. Even the idea of materialism is not made of material.
Right, right. It's sort of self-defeating, you know, because it's an idea that's not made out of material, and they want to use that to prove that there's materialism.
Exactly.
And then we also have other things, like, for instance, truth, concepts. Truth isn't material, but all know that it exists.
That's right.
Mathematics is not material, but we know that it exists. Two plus two is four, but you can't weigh it. You can't take it and dissect it. I mean, it's not something that has physical properties.
Exactly.
Yet, clearly, it exists.
Exactly.
So, well, make a distinction between evolution and natural selection.
Okay. Natural selection is a term which describes a certain concept that forms the package of concepts that comprise evolution. So to understand biological evolution, the idea of natural selection is very important. Basically, what natural selection says is that over the course of time, if you have different varieties of a certain kind of animal or plant, among those varieties, only one or two, only a few will survive due to the conditions being adverse against the other varieties. For example, if you had a variety of giraffes, some which were very tall, some which were tall but not extremely tall, and others which were short. And supposing they were placed for some reason in an environment where there were only tall trees, what would happen is all the short giraffes wouldn't be able to reach the food.
Right.
Therefore, they don't have a survival advantage. And over a period of time, you'd expect all the short giraffes to die out. The only giraffes that would be able to survive would be the ones which are tall enough to reach the tall trees.
Right.
And so it would appear over a period of time that in general, all giraffes have become taller. So that's an example of natural selection. Natural selection is a part of what is used to comprise the theory of evolution.
Okay, okay. Now we know in school, biology class, society in general, evolution is considered scientific. Creation is considered not scientific. So what does the scientific evidence actually say about evolution?
Okay, to look at the evidence, the first thing I'd like to mention is the fossil record. Buried in the stones and in the Earth in general are literally hundreds of thousands, even millions of fossils of various plants and animals. There's no dearth to the amount of fossils available. But when we look at the fossils, there is no clear evidence for evolution at all. Because according to the theory of evolution, an animal, for example, which couldn't fly, evolves over millions of years to become an animal that could fly.
Right.
So you would expect that over the course of time, there would be many instances of that animal evolving through different stages where it would sprout wings, for example, but where the wings were not fully functional. So you would have to have many intermediate forms. So you'd expect that the fossil record would have intermediate forms of different kinds to show you the transitions between two different kinds of animal, one with less functionality and one with more functionality. But when you do look at the fossil record, what you find is completely formed animals,
yeah,
which are fully functional. And there's no indication from the fossil record, as would be expected, of intermediate forms, if evolution were true.
And you make a very good point there, because if evolution was true, then we should see all of these things changing from one form to another, whereas there is absolutely no evidence of anything changing from one form to another. And in fact, there should be a lot more of those than anything that is fully formed.
Exactly.
Because according to evolution, everything is still evolving, it's still
exactly.
changing. So the fact that there are no fossil records is very telling. But what we hear on TV is that, you know, the fossil records, and they make it sound like the fossil records are so clear, clearly support evolution, and it has a lot of people blinded. A lot of people have been fooled by the fact that, you know, that supposedly scientists have supported evolution through the fossil records.
Absolutely. It should be pointed out that the fossil record does not support evolution. Secondly, evolution is not observable because, by definition, it takes millions of years.
Right.
So whoever embraces evolution has to embrace evolution on the basis of faith, not on the basis of observation, which is the hallmark of scientific theory. Scientific theories they become theories through their hypothesis verified by experiments, verified by observations. Evolution is a theory which cannot be verified by observation.
You make a very good point there. You use the word that I want to talk about. You said it takes faith. Most people believe that if you become a Christian or a theist of any type, that you're basing everything on faith, strictly on faith, nothing else. And that science is the opposite, that science bases everything on fact. But the actual truth is that science bases a lot of things on faith. And as a matter of fact, it takes more faith to be an atheist. It takes more faith to be a Darwinist because the evidence simply doesn't support it.
Absolutely.
And I think Darwin himself said, he actually wrote, after he came up with this theory, he actually wrote that if after 100 years the fossil record didn't bear him out, then his theory would be wrong.
Absolutely.
And that is exactly what happened, yet the theory is still being promoted.
That is true. Evolutionists are very staunch in their beliefs. And what we should show is that the creation view, the view that theists hold, and especially the view that Christians hold, that comes from the Bible, actually is supported by
right.
the evidence. So it's not just that we disprove evolution based on the evidence, but the same evidence that we look at lends support to a much easier, much more rational theory to believe, namely the theory of creation, especially as taught by the scriptures.
That brings me to my next question. What is the biblical view of creation?
Well, before we discuss the biblical view of creation, we need to briefly discuss the biblical view of God, because many religions that hold to a view of God also hold to a view of evolution. For example, Hinduism is a religion. Mm-hmm. It therefore assumes the existence of deity in some form or the other. But Hinduism has within it implicit the idea of evolution. So the first thing to distinguish is what kind of God are we talking about? Hinduism and Buddhism and other religions are pantheistic, meaning that they don't see any difference between God and the universe.
Right.
So for them, nature, what we call nature, is itself intelligent and informed and capable of producing order.
Okay.
But if you read the Christian account, the Judeo-Christian account from the Bible, what you find is that, firstly, God is a personal being who is completely non-material has nothing to do with the creation. God is totally distinct, completely separate from the creation.
Right.
And so the creation is something that God produced by an act of his will. And the creation was produced intelligently with purpose. That's to be contrasted with evolution, where evolution is a purposeless, random process, whereby it appears that literally out of chaos we get order. But in the creation account, God produces the order by his own power, by his own intelligence. So everything in the creation, if you look at the world through the eyes of, through the worldview of creation, the world is a purposeful place.
Right. And it's obvious. And you use the word here that I think says it all. You said that God brought it about by his will. And that's very important, because that proves that the God who created the universe is a person, is personal, because he has volition. He can make decisions. He can decide to do things and decide not to do other things. So this wasn't some grand accident, but it was a person who actually made the decision to create and did create.
Exactly. The most important distinguishing feature for us today as a society is to realize that according to evolution, human beings are just highly evolved animals.
Right.
We are a product of a series of accidents. We're not here for any reason. We don't have any ultimate purpose. But if you look at the creation view, we are created in the image of God and after his likeness. We bear his image in many ways. Among them, we have a moral nature and a spiritual nature.
Right.
So if you believe evolution, you lose the idea of morality and spirituality, because evolution does not account for the emergence of morals and the emergence of a spiritual hunger that's so evident in the world today.
That brings me to the next question. Okay, you talked about evolution, and we've talked about what the Bible says. Are these compatible? Because there are people who believe that, well, couldn't God have brought about creation through evolution? So are these two views compatible?
They are not compatible. If you look at creation as taught by the Judeo-Christian scriptures, by both the Old Testament and New Testament, it's very clear that they're not compatible. Because according to the scriptures, God is the author of every kind of life form, both plants and animals. And human beings were created specifically and specially different from the rest of the creation. So there's a distinction between animals and plants on the one hand,
right,
and human beings on the other hand. If you look at evolution, basically it's a purposeless, random process which doesn't really differentiate between, on a philosophical level, human beings are not differentiated from animals. We're just basically animals. Someone who espouses evolution cannot believe in creation and vice versa, because creation basically says that we have a moral nature,
right,
and we have a spiritual nature. So our urges and desires need to be regulated according to a moral law, which makes perfect sense. If there was a creator,
right,
then the creator gives us the moral law,
right,
to guide us.
Right.
But if evolution is true, then every desire of ours basically has no... in other words, there's no reason to curb any desire that we feel, because it's basically our nature. It's our instinct. So there is no definition of sin as such if you believe in evolution. And I would say that's the easiest way to show that someone cannot believe in biblical creation and also in evolution. First is the lack of purpose in evolution versus the existence of purpose in the creation view. The second is the lack of understanding of sin, which is crucial to understanding why Christ came into the world and died for us. If there is no sin, then Christianity doesn't make sense.
And why would God choose to create through evolution? Evolution is a cruel way to bring about a desired end.
Exactly. If we look at the creation process, according to the scriptures, when God created the world and when he created life, the world was a perfect place. There was no disease, there was no suffering, there was no survival of the fittest, which is a central part of evolution. Evolution says that it was through the struggle for survival, through the lack of resources for some animals, because other animals got the resources, that evolution happened and one species became another species. But according to creation, there was no such struggle in the beginning.
Right.
The earth was created a perfect place, a paradise, where all animals and plants lived in harmony with man.
And the biblical account gives worth and dignity to humans.
That is correct.
Because we're made in the image of God. We have a God who loves us, and he created us, and he cares for us, and he's attentive to us. Whereas in evolution, we're just all accidents. You know, nothing ultimately matters.
Exactly.
You know, we're just here.
Exactly. We got here by accident, and we don't have any future as such beyond our material existence.
I want to talk about some of the specifics of design and why there's no such thing as a simple life forms, because, you know, evolutionists will say, well, you know, it started out simple life forms and then it, you know, graduated to more complex life forms and more complex life forms. Touch on that a little bit. Why do we know that there's really no such thing as simple life?
Absolutely. If we look at a single-celled animal, there are many such single-celled animals, basically bacteria or amoeba. Even if you looked at one cell of a human being, you find that it's so complicated that some have even said it's more complex than the space shuttle. And you're just looking at one cell. Now, essentially, all living creatures, whether they're plants or animals, are composed of cells. And cells always have within them a nucleus with a DNA.
Right.
So basically, the DNA is really it's a series of instructions that go to explain how to structure this cell,
right,
and how to give it the functionality. And not only the functionality of a cell, but also the functionality of the whole body.
Right.
So your DNA is what determines what type of living creature you will be.
Right.
So the
right.
DNA is best understood as documentation, instructions,
right,
on how to make the body of that animal or plant develop and how to make it function. So what we see is really an evidence for design. If you were to look up into the sky and see a cloud formation looking like the word Coca-Cola,
yeah,
you would assume that there's a designer, there's someone intelligent responsible for that cloud formation. You wouldn't think that it was random.
Right.
Our normal experience teaches us that the existence of design, especially functional design, in other words, design not just as something that's decorative, but design that is able to execute functions, like wings made in such a way to permit the animal to fly.
Yeah.
Or some animals, for example, have sonar. Bats have sonar capability. They can send sound waves that bounce off of trees in pitch darkness,
yeah,
and they can tell where a wall is or where a tree is. So functional design calls for, philosophically, the existence of a creator.
Even just looking at the human body, I mean, the human body just amazes me. When we just, there's so many things we just take for granted. We were talking the other day about how complex the eye is.
Exactly. If you look at human eyes, the eyes are actually capable of stereoscopic vision. In other words, because that we have two eyes, we can actually get the sensation of depth, of distance.
Yeah.
Now, if you close one eye and you looked at a room full of objects, you cannot tell which object is further from you and which object is closer to you. But with two eyes, you can. The eyes not only function as instruments through which you can see, but the eyes are actually connected to your brain, and you can actually store images.
Yeah.
So it's like storing a movie,
yeah,
that started from your earliest childhood.
Yeah.
You can actually store images and then recall them. So you look at that type of functionality that you have, and then you look at a video camera, which is invented only recently after thousands of years of human existence,
yeah,
and you realize that all the technology that we've discovered and been able to invent has been a part of our human body from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that amazes me about the eye, and I didn't really start to realize this until I started looking at, you know, technologies like, you know, talking about cameras and stuff. But when the eye walks into a room that's dark, it adjusts itself. I mean, it adjusts to the surroundings. If you walk out into the sunlight, then it adjusts itself again. I mean, automatically, without you thinking about it. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to say, okay, light, I'm in the dark now. Could you really tone it down a little bit? I want to be able to see what's going on around, but the eye does it automatically, and that's just, I find that fascinating. And
yeah, actually about the eye, the eye focuses in two ways. One, and it happens automatically. One is the lenses. The lens of the eye adjusts almost immediately. It starts adjusting as soon as you go into a bright place,
yeah,
your pupils constrict. If you go into a dark place, your pupils dilate. But if you've ever been stargazing, if you go into pitch darkness out in an open field to look at stars, the eye actually takes anywhere between 45 minutes and 2 hours to adjust itself to pitch darkness. So it's a different kind of focusing. It takes longer time. And if you are out there for over 2 hours, you can actually see more stars with the naked eye than when you first went there.
Yeah, and I find that fascinating. And hearing also, I think, like I said, there's so many things we don't even think about. I was reading somewhere and they were talking about how complicated it is just for the brain to know when it hears a sound, where is it coming from? I mean, things we take for granted, but the brain actually has to do some serious calculations, you know, based upon which ear receives it and all that type of stuff. And it really does some sophisticated things in order to just determine where something is coming from. We just take these things for granted.
Absolutely, we do. And it's time we exposed the amount of design that exists within the human body and made the public aware of it, because that's the best way to argue against evolution. It's not just to show that evolution is bankrupt, but to show that the theory of creation makes perfect sense.
Talk a minute about irreducible complexity.
Well, irreducible complexity is a little more of a technical term to explain why certain structures in a cell couldn't be any simpler. The idea of evolution is that simple structures, simple cells, simple organisms became more complex.
Right.
So that if you have a very simple animal, its eyes were probably very simple. And if you have a complicated animal, it also has eyes, but its eyes are superior. While this may be true, to show this to be a fact, you have to show that from the beginning of life, from the beginning of the very first cell, every function that cell had could increase gradually in complexity. Now, if you looked at a mousetrap, the easiest example to understand irreducible complexity is to look at a mousetrap. A mousetrap has just the bare minimum number of parts. It's got the actual trapdoor, it's got the steel spring, and it's got bait, and it's got the actual the cage, if you will. Remove any one part of this, and the mousetrap isn't going to work. So if you can make a complicated mousetrap with thousands of parts, potentially, and you can then start simplifying it, so that would be evolution in reverse. But when you get to the simplest mousetrap, you cannot get any simpler. So if you play the evolution video back all the way to the beginning, when you get to the beginning, you have a problem. Because for the first eye to have existed, just like the mousetrap, there needed to be a minimum number of parts, fully coordinated, fully functional, in place from the beginning. And you can't get any simpler. So the fact that this is so is really militates against the theory of evolution and shows it to be false.
And the fact that a cell, nothing evolves into a cell. You either have a working, fully functional cell or you don't. And a cell is irreducibly complex.
Exactly.
Nothing can evolve until you have it.
Exactly.
If you don't have the cell, you have nothing. You have no building blocks. You have absolutely nothing.
Exactly.
Well, Prem, that actually will take us out today. That's time has gone by pretty fast.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to thank you for coming on the show, and that about do it. I'm Harold Felder. You've been watching Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next week. And until then, goodbye and God bless.